Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Nate Langston, and this text message was sent on Sunday, the 1st of March, 2015. Now, joining me this week to discuss the top UK technology news of the hour is nobody, because I'm alone in the corner of my studio at home with nobody here to talk to. That's because they're all at Mobile World Congress in Barcelona. Admittedly, I have normally been there myself, but this year I had some other things to do, like new job and a new podcast and sleeping. So I'm not there this year. I'm not particularly missing out, I don't think, because I never really enjoyed Barcelona's mobile trade show in its later era, if you like. It's a bit of a mad rush to take photos of devices that all kind of look the same, and I got a bit bored of that. So I'm not going to that this year, but I will be talking in bullet point form almost about some of my highlights of devices and technologies that have so far trickled out of the, I was going to say, Mobile World cervix, but that sounds incredibly disgusting. I apologize for the mental image. I'll just be talking about some of my highlights of things that have been released, such as a 200 gigabyte micro SD card. Yes, that's the thing the size of a tooth that can store as much data as you could fit on about 8 Blu-ray discs. I'm going to be talking about that. We're also going to be talking about 5G. That's the, you know what 4G is? That's the thing that costs a lot of money and doesn't serve much benefit to most people versus 3G. And that is already looking to be a little bit long in the tooth, because 5G is being discussed, specifically 1 terabit per second 5G. I'm going to be joined by Alistair Stevenson from the website V3, because V3 had a great exclusive this week about this 1 terabit per second 5G network test that happened in the United Kingdom. And I really wanted to know what this means potentially for the future of British mobile networks and businesses. Also, in the second half of the show, I'm keeping Alistair around. I've glued his feet to the floor and he has no shoes on. He will literally have to rip the skin from his feet to escape my conversational clutches. And we are going to be talking about some of the non-device specific things and trends and products and announcements that we expect to come out of Mobile World Congress. Things like security, the government's backdoor access into your SIM cards, that kind of stuff. But anyway, first we're going to do some news. So rather than a rundown of all the week's news and discussion, because I have no one here to talk to, so I'm just going to shout into this silent little corner that I have in my room in West London, I'm just going to talk about some of the things that have come out of Mobile World Congress so far that I think are worthy of comment. And the first is that Samsung has announced, of course, the Galaxy S6 phone, which has had a much more significant design overhaul than the S5 did over the S4. Now, an Apple fan may think it looks a bit like the glass front has been taken from the back of the iPhone 5 and been blended with the curved metal edges of the iPhone 6. But who am I to say? That it is definitely the nicest looking Galaxy phone for sure. I don't think I've seen one that I liked as much as this, certainly not since the S3 came out. And inside, Samsung has tossed Qualcomm to the curb as far as processors are concerned, which is really bad news for Qualcomm, of course. Samsung's the second biggest, I think, customer of Qualcomm. And unlike Apple, which designs its own ARM-based chips for its products but gets other companies to manufacture them, Samsung can manufacture its own, and that's what it's doing for the S6. It's got an octa-core processor, and my scrutinizing of the benchmarks reveal that the phone has 8 cores running at 1.5 gigahertz each. That's 8 CPU cores all at 1.5 gigahertz each. Most of them last year were 4 cores. We've now got 8, and there's 3 gig of RAM. And in total, it looks like the performance is actually going to be better than the Galaxy Note 4, which is pretty interesting. The other big change for the S6 is that it's got a sealed body, meaning no micro SD card support and no removable battery. Now, that's really weird, because the S5, or certainly most of the Galaxy line, one of the biggest selling points was the fact that versus the iPhone, you can change the batteries. So even if it does suck up all the juice in there, you can at least carry a second one, or if you need to. It also means it's lost the waterproofing, which is bizarre, where the S5 could be dropped in toilets or baths, or indeed any container rich with fluid. I'm not here to judge or suggest, the S6 cannot. So if you do drown this one after getting used to being able to bathe with your S5, you'll just have to buy a new one from Samsung. Oh no, whatever will Samsung do, having to sell you another phone to replace the broken one you put in some water? Elsewhere, there is a new HTC One M9, which has an octa-core processor as well, except this one comes from Qualcomm. But further benchmark scrutinization on my part suggests that it's less powerful than Samsung's octa-core competitor, even though both chips run at 1.5 gigahertz. Are you keeping up? Sorry about all the jargon there. But there is very little physical difference with the new M9 versus the predecessor. The battery is actually a little bit bigger, with the clock speed of the of Qualcomm's maybe being a little bit lower possibly than Samsung's. It could be that we get better battery life, and that's only a good thing in the world of smartphones. So what else has excited me from Mobile World Congress so far? Got to go back to that 200 gigabyte micro SD card from SanDisk. That's a memory card the size of a tooth. This is my highlight from the show so far, because yearly upgrade cycles of Android phones kind of don't hold my interests for more than about three paragraphs of brain time, but a 200 gigabyte storage capacity on a micro SD chip, that colours me very excited. It's going to cost probably about £300. I've seen a $400 price tag knocking around, so I would imagine about £299 once this hits the UK market. And obviously you can't actually put this in your Galaxy S6 because it doesn't have that slot anymore. So I think it makes a very interesting candidate for some of these high-resolution portable audio players that require enormous amounts of storage space for high-definition studio albums. You can carry several of these if you're wealthy enough and value high-resolution audio so much, and maybe being able to carry a terabyte of high-res albums around on five of these 200-gig little discs is pretty exciting to high-end audio people. So that's they're some of my highlights. I was going to mention as well the Valve VR headset called the Vive, which it turns out is being manufactured by HTC. This is kind of a competitor to the Oculus Rift or Samsung's Gear VR. But the reason I particularly like this one, apart from the fact that it's developed in partnership with Valve, who makes Steam and Half-Life and Portal and things, is the fact that this thing comes with a base station that can track your movement in a room up to 15 by 15 feet. This means when you put this headset on and stand in the middle of your room to play a game, you can walk around your room and it will, and your character potentially could be walking around the room on screen. Now, it does probably require a higher insurance premium on your house, given all the animals and precious objects that you may run into when fleeing ever more realistically rendered zombie faces. But if you're wealthy enough or do not value anything in your home, then this is pretty exciting, and I'm definitely one of those people. I dearly look forward to breaking a leg while chasing zombies. So we'll probably have more to talk about next week when Ian returns from Barcelona, and we'll see what other technology journalists who've been out at MWC I can drag on, glue to the floor, and interrogate for your interest and entertainment. So do come back. I wanted to just end the news segment by returning to the topic of 5G, and this is because there was a story on V3 written by Dan Wirth, who writes that 5G speeds of 1 terabit per second have been achieved during tests at the University of Surrey. Now, Professor Rahim Tafozali, who I'm not sure I pronounced the name correctly, is director of the 5G Innovation Center at the university, and he told V3 that it was the first time in the world that such speeds had been achieved, and it's far faster than other tests known, such as Samsung's 7.5 gigabit per second result. So he explained that the company, or rather that the 5G Innovation Center, had been working on new technologies to support 5G services, which have been instrumental in producing the 1 terabit per second result. So he actually said, and this is a quote, "We've developed 10 more breakthrough technologies, and one of them means we can exceed 1 terabit per second wirelessly. This is the same capacity as fiber optics, but we're doing it wirelessly." Now, this is really interesting, and according to the report, the plan is to take the technology outside the lab and onto the campus at the university during next year or 2017 before demonstrating it to the public in early 2018, allegedly ahead of rivals from South Korea, Russia, and Japan. Now, here's where things get interesting. 5G seems to be anything between about 1 gigabit per second and now 1 terabit per second. That is a huge margin. That is a 1,000-fold difference between the two. Depending on who you ask, at least, that's where 5G seems to fall between. And that also depends on how the tech is being tested, either in a strictly controlled laboratory experiment, like the 1 terabit per second one here. So I met up with V3's Alistair Stevenson to explain really a bit more about what went on behind this trial.
So at the moment, they've said these guys are in test conditions, around 1 terabit per second. And what we've actually seen by other people, like Samsung, is 7.5 gigabits per second. And then Ofcom, who are sort of talking about 2020, are saying there'll be a maximum of 50 gigabits per second. So breaking the terabit set light line is kind of a big deal, fairly important.
But this is all in lab conditions over the spread of 100 meters apart. I mean, you can recreate a lot of very successful trials, but as we've seen so many times, once it hits cities, once you put buildings in the way, suddenly 1 terabit starts looking a little terrible.
Yeah, that's completely right. And they have actually said this is all test conditions, and they haven't taken it outside yet. And another thing that actually is important to note is while they've got these speeds, they haven't solved the latency problem at the moment. And latency is actually going to be the bigger driver that's going to cause problems for future applications. Because obviously, you know, machines and parts waiting to speak to each other can cause stutters and chugs. So even if you've got these really fast speeds, it could still be not that great when it comes to actual performance or download speeds.
Did they give you any indication as to what the best reason for this to exist is? I mean, we're not talking about initially consumers downloading high-res 4K video files. I mean, I presume we're talking about shifting huge volumes of data from one space center to another.
I mean, yeah, completely. As always with these new technologies, it'll be the enterprise and government departments that'll get it first. I mean, you know, the NSA were among the first to get supercomputers. It's always that way. So this will be much more big data analytics on the move and people accessing cloud systems and that sort of thing, as opposed to consumers, as you said, downloading massive 4K media files.
Alistair Stevenson from V3 there. Now, we'll hear more from Alistair shortly. But first, we have a couple of emails that have come into podcast@natelangson.com, our shiny new email address. Andy writes, just listened to the podcast and the first section on toilet roll poetry was the most random segment I've ever listened to on a tech podcast. Loved it. P.S. I would leave an iTunes review, but don't use iTunes or any Apple products, and I suspect I'm not the only one. If leaving a review somewhere else would help, do mention it on the next podcast. Well, to be perfectly honest with you, at this point, iTunes really is the place that would make the most difference to get those reviews. As much as people do love to not love Apple products and iTunes, as far as podcasters are concerned, that's where about 90%, if not more, of our referrals and our downloads and our subscribers come from. It really is that much. So leaving a review, even if it's just a case of signing up a free account to leave the review, those sorts of things help. So you'll have to think long and hard about how much you want to help the show get noticed. But if you don't want to leave one on iTunes, then obviously anything on Twitter, or just mention it to a friend who you think will enjoy the show, get them to download it, maybe put it on their phone for them. I'm assuming it is an Android, so I recommend Pocket Casts. That's what I use anyway. That would be really helpful. But thank you, Andy, and I'm glad you enjoyed last week's show. We also have another email from Tom. Now, Tom writes in with a point on Touch ID that we were talking about the other week, which involves fingerprint sensors for unlocking mobile banking apps on mobile phones. Tom says, I was talking to someone at my local bank at the excitement and easiness of Touch ID for banking. However, he came up with a very great point. Unlike a password or fingerprint, it can't be changed. So once your fingerprint is hacked, then the ease of use drops significantly. I understand we have other digits, but it's the equivalent of texting with your other hand. I'm wondering what you think. Now, I actually think this is a great point, Tom. And obviously, we are in a world where two-factor authentication is encouraged. So fingerprint plus something else, maybe a text message, maybe something that doesn't require only the fingerprint. But I think realistically, the goal here is to prevent people from being able to steal a phone and quickly get access to your money. And while, yes, you can hack a fingerprint or you can clone a fingerprint, the speed at which you're going to be able to do that, I think, is going to inhibit the need to even try and do that. As soon as they've cloned a finger, you're going to have disabled your phone, alerted your bank. You know, it's one of the first things we do when we lose a phone is we change our passwords and things like that, let banks know. So I do think it's a good point, but I think that the need to worry about that is probably quite small, just because of the amount of time it's going to take to clone a fingerprint. Anyone else with other views on that, of course, very welcome to email podcast@natelangson.com. Thanks to Tom and Andy for their comments for this week's show.
Right, well, joining me now, who you've heard in the first half of the show today, is Alistair Stevenson from V3. Hello, Alistair.
Hello, Nate, and hello, everyone else.
This is nice. We get to talk without a time limit of, can you explain 5G in 60 seconds, please? This is good. So we are talking about Mobile World Congress, a topic I'm sure no other technology podcasts are discussing this week.
Well, you know, it does stay under the hood every year.
It really does. But we didn't want to talk about just the big phones because I'm kind of bored by them. They're all the same these days anyway. I'm not really interested. Until I get 8 gigs of RAM in a phone, I'm not really that interested. So we want to talk about what we think are going to be the most important things that we're going to get out of Mobile World Congress. Let's take it as given that there's going to be a Galaxy S6. There's going to be a new HTC, there's going to be smartwatches from HTC, and Sony's going to be releasing another phone. In fact, I think it's just announced at the E4 today as we record anyway. What would you say? What's your trend? What are you keeping your eye on, Alistair?
I think for me, the big thing I'm going to be watching, obviously, is going to be the sort of what I always like to think of as the Illuminati guys at MWC, you know, the tech people who make it so people can make things like the Galaxy S6. I mean, we've already had, you know, ARM announce their new Cortex. Intel are obviously going to react to that, so you're going to have the new processors, which will probably inform what's going on with Samsung and a few other people.
So this is ARM. For anyone who doesn't know, ARM designs a lot of the chips that power things like the Qualcomm Snapdragons that go in most of the high-end phones. Intel currently is not even a player in that field. So you reckon Intel, owner of basically the entire desktop market, at least in the Western economies, is going to start doing more with mobile phones?
Well, they've already been shifting to mobile devices for quite a long time, and we had Merrifield and Moorfield last year. The problem is they've not got much traction with it. I mean, you see them appear in a few what I would describe as low-end Android tablets. You know, they've got Asus, Dell, HP, the kind of business guys using them. But yeah, they haven't had any penetration like Qualcomm. To be honest, we talked about wearables. What's going to be interesting more from Intel is, putting aside mobile phones, their move towards Internet of Things, and that could involve smartwatches and things like that, but also they've also got microsensors. I mean, we had Edison last year, now they brought out their new version, Curie.
Yeah, the button-sized.
Yes.
Button, the processor designed for wearables so small it fits in a shirt button.
Exactly.
That was pretty impressive. I have to say, Intel, you can criticize Intel for being massive or for being, for getting their ass kicked for sort of deals that they struck with PC makers that was around sort of mid-2000s. But they are making some very, very interesting advances in really tiny computers. I mean, getting a processor or a system on a chip, I suppose, specifically, which is not just a processor, but it's the memory controllers and, you know, potentially graphics, Wi-Fi, all that kind of stuff, inside something that can fit in a cloth, for want of a better word.
It's insane, yeah.
It's remarkable. Do you think we're going to see more of that Mobile Congress?
I think they're finally going to start making good of some of it. Intel have made no secret of the fact that they want to own the Internet of Things market, both, you know, in the enterprise and in the consumer space, which is why they're putting so much research into this. I think that's going to have a lot of, you know, interesting connotations when they come to, because even if we don't get, a final product, you can get proof of concepts and ideas about what's going to be going on with it. I mean, last year they had a smart coffee cup, which I thought was brilliant.
Yeah.
But I think we're going to get more interesting uses of it, especially in areas which are going through a bit of a technology renaissance, like healthcare, government. I mean, you know, the government at the moment is spending lots on this. So if you have trackers and things, which you can put security guards or even just enterprise executives.
Let's actually talk about that more, because obviously as a journalist, as a tech journalist, and V3, as a big part of its focus, is security and enterprise. And, you know, a big emphasis on wearables is obviously personal data collection. Personal usage of personal data collection, you know, fitness trackers and things. But that does bring to the question, well, if everything's connected, how am I going to be monitored even more, potentially? That's the concern that Mr. and Mrs. Lehman have out in the street today. I saw them outside in the rain. They look concerned. They said, I don't want my heartbeat going into my button and having that button going through the NSA and GCHQ. I just want my shirt to be able to tell my fridge it needs to order some chocolate because my belly is getting a little too small and I need to build it out again. That's all they want. Should they be concerned?
I'm going to put my tinfoil hat on for a second and say, absolutely.
Wow.
IoT is a wild west completely. We're talking back in the days of computing where some people are saying they're designing things, you know, secure by design, but most people aren't. And there's not even a common standard about how these sensors are going to work or what they're going to do. And data privacy laws are still playing catch up, so there's not even a way to know if they do capture all this data, it's illegal, which of course was, we mentioned the NSA, the GCHQ used that defense constantly when their practices, you know, Operation Tempura and things were going on. And I think at the moment, nobody really knows what's going on with security, and the first people who are going to be able to figure out how to make money of it aren't going to be people like Intel. They'll be criminals who are taking this data and selling it, because at the moment, it is worth a lot of money.
Okay. So is this, tracking this back to Mobile World Congress then, is this is something that you're particularly interested then in seeing what comes out of this, because it's moved on from just being about mobile phones, it became tablets, it became bigger. Now it's about anything that is... It feels like anything that is a personal and portable computing device with an ability to communicate with another device seems to be fair game as far as Mobile World Congress is concerned. It's becoming the most important technology trade show of the year, I think. Almost at this point, more so than CES, certainly for anything mobile.
I definitely think so on that front. I mean, every year I go to MWC and I used to speak to people like Samsung, we started that earlier, HTC, whereas now I'm going to be speaking to people from Cisco, Juniper Networks, security experts like Mikko Hipponen from F-Secure, who of course was the first guy who said, mobile malware will be a thing. Everybody laughed at him. And then we now have, 600,000 malware variants targeting Android alone.
Mm. How many are targeting iOS, do you know?
Well, Apple will never tell you that.
No.
They don't discuss security.
No. See, there's always been this debate in the PC versus Mac community that Macs are more secure than Windows, which statistically may appear true. And I'm a Mac user, and I don't install any antivirus on my system at all. And I have been criticized by a guy actually who works for AVG, who said, well, it's not just about you. What if you're passing on to somebody else? And I was like, well, that is a fair point. But I still don't, because I feel, personally, I do feel secure using a Mac with that antivirus. But some people do comment that it's not that the platform's more secure, it's just that fewer people are targeting them because it's not seen as a viable target to get a return on investment, if you like, because there aren't enough Mac users compared to PC users. But in the iOS world, that's a very different case, kettle of fish. You know, there's over 1 billion iOS devices out in the world now. Apple, just in one quarter of last year alone, sold almost 75 million iPhones. One product in 3 months, 75 million. That doesn't count iPads. That doesn't count iPod touches. So, you know, and that was the same, pretty much the same number as Samsung shifted phones as well. So, big target, and yet we've not seen any serious repeated attacks on iOS.
No. iOS, going against Android, it's very much this open system versus closed system. The closed system is always going to win out because Apple pre-vets, there's a lot of security checks, whereas Google with Android takes an open approach where it sort of says, innovate, do what you want with iOS, which of course leaves it open to abuse. It's, you know, two-edged sword. It means Android can get innovations to the market faster, technically will be adapted more easily. But when it comes to security now, I think there's going to be an interesting shift. Android will always be less secure just because of that fundamental point. But, for example, today we've had Google Android for Work, which adds, you know, enterprise mobility management upgrades. It's had support from BlackBerry, which is, despite the fact that it has not made a good device for God knows how long, great when it comes to secure comms. And if you have a BlackBerry enterprise server, it's still
pretty solid. And for a long time, it was the only one that governments would allow any government official to use. You know, Obama, famously BlackBerry user. But eventually, iPhone and Samsung, I think it was with Knox, Samsung's Knox
system,
eventually got approved for use, and they can be, I think, now used by governments. But I wanted to just move the conversation forward a little bit. There was a conveniently timed announcement earlier this week about the SIM card manufacturer Gemalto, and I wondered, throwing this on you, because I hadn't mentioned this to you ahead of recording, but it was an interesting one. This was a story about the SIM company Gemalto. It was discovered that the US government, I think, wasn't it, had managed to effectively hack the SIM cards so that data could be monitored. And it basically meant that anyone who had a Gemalto manufactured SIM card suddenly was thinking, you know, has my call been monitored? Because regardless of device, it allowed access to the SIM card technology itself. So do you think there's going to be any revelations about those sorts of areas of the industry? I mean,
absolutely. I mean, we're talking about government-grade attacks here. You know, we mentioned the NSA having a supercomputer before. They have a lot of resources. And targeted attacks, any security expert will tell you, if somebody has enough will and a focus on you, not necessarily for financial gain, so they're not going to go away if somebody's easier to attack, they'll get their way in. I mean, human error can do it, or as you said, a SIM card crack. And we've also seen they are not above breaking technologies. I mean, they compromised RSA encryption protocols and, you know, pushed dodgy standards knowingly.
Yeah.
So, you know, these technologies are going to be vulnerable, and you will see them be device agnostic. If they want to get data from somebody who has an iPhone, they will get the iPhone if they want it.
Wow.
Even if it's clubbing over the head and then breaking his password with a brute force attack.
Well, that's given us a lot to think about, and definitely should give people an idea of some other things to look out for from Mobile World Congress, apart from just the new product releases. Maybe dig a little bit deeper, I guess, from Alistair's reporting on V3 and from elsewhere on the web, to have a look at some of these maybe smaller stories that are coming out of Mobile World Congress about security, about SIM card technologies. Maybe they will be the next big thing you'll see in the mainstream headlines. Before we go, though, I just wanted to see if you thought there's going to be anything on the positive note, because we have basically told people the world is imploding and they should be terrified. What's going to excite you most, do you think, this year that wasn't there last year? And I mean excite in the positive sense, not excite because there's a great headline, because you've seen a SIM card kill someone.
Well, that would be a sight to see. But no, I think, as I said, for what's going to interest me are going to be maybe some future tech projections. So I think once we get a bit more traction about seeing what's going on with, as I said, things like Curie, you know, like these little microcomputers for wearables, I think that's going to be very exciting and potentially take off this year. Mm. The other thing, I think my main takeaway, which I'm going to be really, really interested in, are some of the telecom providers' solutions. At the moment, there's a big thing going off, you know, back onto the tangent about security, about network monitoring. And everybody's sort of trying to push and find a way to make sure that they can tell their customers your data is safe. I mean, you've got Deutsche Telekom, who promised last year to put all their technologies through local data centers. Apple has sort of moved to do that with their data center news this week. I think the big thing that I'm going to be looking forward to is seeing some of these, you know, promises bear fruit and seeing what the actual solutions they've come up to these massive problems are.
Hmm. Great. Well,
Alistair Stevenson there from V3. You can hear more from Alistair at v3.co.uk and follow him on Twitter at MonkeyGuru. I'm not here to judge, neither should you, at MonkeyGuru. Thank you, Alistair Stevenson, and thank you for listening. Please, please keep listening. Tell a friend. At this stage in a podcast's life, it means a hell of a lot to people like me who make these on a Sunday night, largely for the fun of doing so, but you know, it really helps the show get noticed. Leave a review or a rating on iTunes. If you can be persuaded to use iTunes, if you're an Apple hater, then, you know, it really does help make a difference to getting the show noticed. Or send email to podcast@natelangson.com and hope that you will join us next week for our post-Mobile World Congress wrap-up with whoever it is I drag into the studio and sellotape to the floor. Bye.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.